Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host for the show, Willem van der Horst. What's been going on in London town these days? Basically, it's been raining. Like, it's coming up to the summer. Well, not exactly the summer right now, but it's been raining like crazy. Yeah, kind of interesting. It's supposed to be like raining and going into storms again. It's kind of a little bit, just kind of warm for London weather, I guess, but sort of sticky. It's a bit of like a colder Singapore. I've been going to an outdoor heated pool. I think I mentioned in another episode. So I've kept up the exercising so far. So far, so good. We're only talking on a weekly basis, but we'll see how it goes. I've got some traveling planned, which I'm very excited about. Just confirmed some trips to the States. I'll be at the Podcast Movement Conference in Chicago. And I'm going to be catching up with some friends. I'm starting a course in Los Angeles, and then I'm going off to Chicago. So this should be pretty awesome. Really looking forward to meeting a lot of different podcasters and learning a lot more about both like the techniques of editing, sound editing, interview techniques, networking with other podcasters. You know, there's some cool keynotes. Kevin Smith is going to be one of the opening keynotes, and Alex Bloomberg is going to be one of the closing keynotes. There's several other podcasters who are going to be there that I'm going to be catching up with. I'm hoping to organize several other meetings and possibly some conversations, maybe for the podcast if I manage while I'm in Chicago. It's the first time I'm going to Chicago, so I'm really excited about it. It should be like really excited about it. Not to repeat myself extreme amount of times, but anyway. For anybody who's just joined the show, doesn't really know what's going on here, this is a show where actually not, you know, we like ice cream, of course, but and I love ice cream. And I love ice cream to be for everyone, but it's not always specifically about ice cream. This is a show where I have conversations with people in fields I'm interested in. I work in marketing and brand strategy with a background in digital, but not only. And another background I have from more personal perspective, I'm really into tabletop games. I really enjoy and fascinated about the process of design in general for a lot of different things. May it be games, may it be other things, anything from websites to how you design furniture. And I basically go and have conversations with people who have an opinion about it or experience about it, like thinkers, designers, creators, and you know, get into the skin of where they come from, who they are, what inspires them, and ask kind of like different questions to get to know who these people are and hopefully learn from it in the process and have some fun. And I make the conversations accessible for everyone. So anybody who's into podcasting, anybody who's into listening to these kinds of interviews or conversations, of course, you know, some are going to be more about marketing and, you know, maybe people who work in marketing, like this particular episode is going to be more interesting. Like last week with the interview with Greg Stolte, that might have been more interesting for people in tabletop role-playing games, but it's open for everyone, right? And if you enjoy it and if you do listen to the show, please, like, you know, think about taking a couple of minutes, giving the show a rating or review on your iPod, on your podcasting app. So that could be like on iTunes or the iPhone podcast app, which I hope you can leave reviews on, or giving it a thumbs up on Stitcher or on whatever podcast app you use, basically, like giving a rating or positive feedback, or just send me a tweet or post something on the Facebook page of Ice Cream for Everyone. You can like the Facebook page. You can tweet at me, and I'm at Hippowell. And you can also find the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter if you want to read more ice cream stuff that I write, new stories every week coming out, and you can sign up on my website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. Ice cream, like the cream, obviously, foreveryone.net. On to today's guests. Very excited. Had an awesome conversation with Mitch Joel. He's a renowned marketer and commentator about the digital marketing industry. He's been holding and writing in a blog and has his own podcast, like has had that for over 10 years. He talks regularly at a number of events, and his podcast is like regularly one of the most recommended in terms of marketing. It's a great podcast. His website called, and the podcast as well, called Six Pixels of Separation. Links in the show notes. But you know, if you look at any top 10 best marketing podcasts to listen to, he's going to be close to the top, basically. And before before working in digital marketing, Mitch had a long career in the music industry, where we talk about that in a conversation. He spent like 10 years interviewing, having conversations with all sorts of bands and musicians. He used to play the bass. Now he also hosts another podcast called Groove, in which he talks with all the very best bass players in the world. He created a digital marketing agency that used to be called Twist Image that was acquired and now is part of an agency called Mirum. And Mitchell is the president of Mirum in Canada. He's based in Montreal, and Mirum's a digital agency owned by the advertising communications agency J. Walter Thompson, and altogether part of the WPP group, the largest, well, ad and media communication group around, basically. So pretty big deal. And we talk about that during the show. We talk about what's going on in the industry. Really, we go over a lot of different topics. We go over his experience interviewing people in the music industry, his appreciation of music, punk and rock bands, and all the way to what's happening now in new technologies, what's exciting. Really cool conversation. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Without further ado, here's Mitch Joel of Six Pixels Separation and the Mirror Agency. Hey Mitch, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. Thanks for taking time for being on the show, essentially.
Thanks for thinking of me.
Nah, well, absolutely. I think it's pretty much a big deal. Like, you're one of the biggest marketing podcasters out there and big job with a big agency. So I'm really, really excited about talking to you.
Well, let's see if I can live up to that.
Let's see. But you'll find out it's not necessarily about having the best predictions or any of the things that you usually talk about in conferences, et cetera. But we'll find out. This is where I wanted to start. There is if I can like scroll down to exactly what I'm like talking about here, what are my notes? I was like, all of a sudden, just before starting the call, like we had to reschedule this call, right? So I was like, oh my God, I'm not prepared. And then I realized I had prepared for the last call. So I was like, okay, I did prepare. I think your agency, Miriam, just won a bunch of new business, right? So I was wondering if congratulations were in order. Was that Canada? Because I knew there was a big win in New York, right? Or...
So yeah, it's sort of both. It's a great question, actually. So the way Miriam was created is it was formed about a bit over a year ago now, mm-hmm. and it was done through primarily acquisition from J. Walter Thompson. So my original agency, Twist Image, which started in 2000, was acquired by WPP about 2 years ago. We report in through the J. Walter Thompson Corporation. They had acquired a bunch of agencies over a period of years, and all of us, about eight of us, came together about a year ago. All of us rebranded as Miriam. And so essentially, I'm still responsible for what we were doing up here in Canada.
Yeah.
But the leaders of all these agencies sit on a global leadership, and being in the global leadership gives you access and opportunities. So the most recent, we got a bunch of wins that are coming out, but the most recent one is that we, meaning the Canadian unit, led a pitch for UNICEF, a global pitch, which was actually based out of New York. So you are correct, but we did win the global digital replatforming of UNICEF that we're really excited about. And even within that, we've had some other wins, both organic and net new business development wins. And so we've added, I think, about 15 people, adding 7 more. That's just in Canada. But, you know, Miriam is really big. I mean, we're closing in on 3,000 employees in 25 plus countries. So that's just Canada. But within the organization, we're constantly hiring and growing. So it's sort of hard to keep track of, to be honest.
That's pretty big. And well, congratulations for the global win. That's a big deal, right?
We're excited. Yeah. I mean, it's just the type of work you want to do. One is it's an amazing organization. Two, whenever you get the chance to do a global replatforming for, you know, web and mobile, I mean, that's the sort of stuff I think people really wake up to do. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are very senior in e-commerce, and their greatest desire is to be able to do the .com of whatever brand they're working on, because that's the sort of big meaty work that, you know, you all strive to do. Campaigns are great. We do a ton of campaigns here, whether they're social or digital in terms of, you know, banners, email, search. Those are great. We love them. But obviously, when you can sort of really pick up and do something and redo it, it's super exciting for sure.
Absolutely. Very exciting. Cool. So another thing I read and that you have on your, I think it was on your LinkedIn profile, of course, one of the main sources of me stalking for the people I'm interviewing, that Marketing Magazine dubbed you a rock star of digital marketing. And while I'm not usually crazy about these buzzwords, in your case, you actually have a real claim to the title, so because you are a musician and a heavy metal fan, right? Or rock musician, or how would you? Yeah.
Well, no, I mean I started off my career writing about music and interviewing, you know, rock stars, and that was my sort of genre, was heavy music, punk, alternative music back in the late 80s, all throughout the 90s and beyond. I do sort of, I know how to play bass. I don't consider myself a bass player because I really don't do that all that much anymore. But I also just have a passion for music. So on the side, I also have a growingly popular podcast where I interview bass players, electric bass players, called Groove. And it's on a platform called notreble.com, which is actually the largest environment for bass players in the world. And I've been doing that for over a year, interviewing the sort of the best in the bass world. I mean, it's fun. I don't know if Marketing Magazine called me that, or if somebody being interviewed about me said, "Oh, that guy's a rock star." I think that's where it came from. Mm-hmm. It's flattering. It's nice. I mean, that's bio stuff that you sort of put in there to promote and hype. And I think I get somewhat embarrassed when people say things like that, because I don't know if it's because I'm Canadian or just by my nature, but I'm someone who prefers that the attention is put on the content I output, not me putting it out.
Yeah. All right. Well, no, absolutely. That's fair. But when did you, your bass playing career itself, was that more of a kind of high school stuff, or?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a career. I started playing it pretty young. Yeah, I started playing it pretty young when I was about 12, and I played it for a long period of time. In fact, post-secondary, I actually studied it, very seriously at the, at the university college level a little bit, in an area here in Quebec. We have something called CEGEP, which is after grade 11, you do 2 years of sort of like this type of almost like university college-like school. And I did that. I studied electric bass as my primary instrument there. Quickly realized that it wasn't the lifestyle that I wanted. I'm a bit of an early bird, not a late night person, and sort of the whole gigging and jamming, and I love doing it. It just wasn't for me in terms of my lifestyle. So, I have a couple of instruments lying around that I'll twiddle with here and there, but I definitely don't have a quarter of the skill that the people that I actually like to connect to about that instrument really do have.
Yeah. Got it. And so if we go back just a tiny bit more, so you're based in Montreal right now. And is that's where you're from as well, or?
Born and raised in Montreal, still live here, very much love the city, very multicultural. I do believe it's the most European city you can get in North America. I love it for its proximity. It's, 45 minutes to Boston, an hour to Toronto, an hour to New York, 6 hours to LA, or 6 hours to London. And just for me, it works out for me. We also have a very large office in Toronto, which is, again, an hour flight from here, and I can basically commute that. So, I love the city. I love the multilingual. I love the multicultural. Yeah. I really do love it.
Because we were talking just a little bit of French before we started. Are both your parents on the kind of French? Are one of your parents on the French side of things, both on the English side of things, or?
Pretty, I would say, it's funny. I always tell people, I would say I'm bilingual. I think people in Quebec would call me Anglophone. Yeah. it's like one of those things where it's just the nature of the beast. You sort of grow up with it here. I think if I had done my education a bit later, meaning just I had been born a little later, meaning I'd be younger now, my French would probably be a lot better. When I was growing up in high school, French was a very important subject, but it was just a subject. It wasn't sort of like the dominant force that it is now up here in Quebec. But I do love the language. I wish I could speak it without translating in my head, and I've never made that transition. My kids are super fluent and really fully functionally bilingual. I struggle with it.
Yeah, got it. That was interesting, because I don't really know much of what's going on. You said it was becoming a dominant force, French, a lot more than it used to be when you were growing up, or?
Well, language is a very hotly political issue here in Quebec, where the province of Quebec wants to separate from the rest of Canada. Yeah. And there's a lot of language laws up here in terms of how much English you can show, which is basically next to nothing. It is very much a French province, Montreal probably being the most bilingual of all the other cities in the province. And it's very contentious here because they want to make it more and more French in a world that's going more and more global and multilingual. So there's always that sort
of tension going on.
Yeah, that underlying tension, exactly.
Right. So I've never actually visited. It was just a bit of a shame. I really want to go. And just as I said before, we're starting to record. My sister-in-law is from Montreal. Her mother's from Montreal. They have a chalet there in Saint-Sauveur, very, very close by. So, and I always hear amazing things about Montreal. And so, yeah, I'd love to visit, and love to visit more of Quebec as well. So anyway, well, that's still in the activity French list. But
yeah, but based on the French I heard, you would probably fare very well here. So
yeah, it'd be okay. And it's like one of the dream locations for most of the French people leaving France,
exactly.
Aside from London, is to go to Quebec, essentially. Yeah. So it's like the dreamland where there's many more jobs and nice people and American food or like all sorts of, and apparently much better politics, according to the French people here talking about it. But anyway, let's not go there. So let's talk about what you studied, actually. So I believe you studied communications journalism. Is that right?
Very candidly, it's hard for me to remember. I really didn't do much post-secondary education. I did CGEP, as I said, started in communications, switched over to music. I spent more than my fair share of time there. It's supposed to be a 2-year run. I did close to 4 years. I did one semester at the sort of college university level, taking a bunch of courses. I believe if I were to reflect back that maybe my major was philosophy. I'm not even sure, but I dropped out basically after a semester. At that point, I already started publishing music magazines, and I just thought I wanted to take a run at being an entrepreneur versus grinding through school, which just for me, you know, the joke that I often say online, which tends to get retweeted and shared, is I often tell people that I didn't let school get in the way of my education. So that's sort of what happened. I wasn't great at school. I was much better at trying to educate myself.
And so how did the publishing music magazines came about? Like, well, let's start. What were some of your major influences in terms of bands? And then how did that kind of making it into a business start out?
I was just one of those people who would always look at the cover of rock magazines back when those were the dominant force of how people learned about new music, and thought, you know, I'd look at the celebrities and not think like, wow, that's so cool. There's, you know, Gene Simmons from Kiss or whatever. I'd look at those things and think, who's the person who gets to interview that person and write the story? I don't know why, but that was sort of my thing. And just from pure, I don't know if it's sort of putting it out in the world or thinking about it so much, I wound up actually writing for some national and local magazines. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty fun gig. And I was really young. I was probably 17 years old at the time. It was almost like that movie Almost Famous. It was just one of those crazy lifestyles where I'd be going to school and at the same time, like, just hanging out backstage and being asked to go on tour and becoming friends with a lot of the newer bands that were getting signed. And I'd get called by A&R people asking me about what I thought about certain bands that then would get signed and become, you know, quite famous.
Was there something that allowed you to start getting into that, a break, or like what was the first article or through somebody?
It was a guy that I knew who had written for a magazine, and he was writing, and I had a computer, and he wasn't great at typing, and I would type up articles for him, and he'd thank me by giving me cassettes and CDs back then and taking me to shows. And one thing led to another, and he just said, why don't you do this interview? It happened to be Tommy Lee from Motley Crue right before Dr. Feelgood came out. I love the band. I'd loved the band since I first saw them in 1982 or 83. And the editor of the magazine saw that, thought it was cool. He let me write the article. I then started writing, and I realized I had a knack and passion and interest in it. The guy who was publishing this magazine got fairly sick at one point, had open heart surgery, made it, and was safe, but decided he didn't want to have this lifestyle. And I was young. I just thought, this is crazy. Like, I don't want this to be over now.
Yeah, of course.
So I just thought, maybe I'll publish my own magazine. And so I started studying it, looking into it, making phone calls. At the time, there really wasn't an internet. I mean, the most progressive technology we had at the time was fax machines. Uh-huh. And so it was interesting calling up editors, asking them what to do. I still have the little black notebook that I took all my notes in, and printer and paper sizes and costs and stuff. And managed to do an ad-supported magazine, which is sort of interesting if you think about where the internet is at, right?
Do you remember any like a memorable, funny moment of an interview that you had back at that time? You'd be able to share with us?
The reversal of it would be like, what band do you like? And I could probably tell you a story. I mean, I was doing this full time. I'd probably do 8 to 10 interviews a week, all over the world. It was press junkets. It was countless memories. I mean, I was here in Montreal when a band pulled up in this little sort of half beaten up school bus playing in a venue where nobody was. And I interviewed them. Their father was one of the fathers was driving the bus, and interviewed them in the back of this hot, stinky thing, and watched them play in a club to nobody was there too. And that band wound up being Green Day. I mean, so I have just countless.
So you do have like all sorts of stories. Yeah.
Yeah, countless stories of bands like seeing, you know, I wound up doing a lot of freelance writing for a very big magazine out of New York called Concrete and Foundations. And they were basically doing promotions for a lot of these up and coming bands. So I was like one of the guys who did the first interviews with bands like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden because they were helping to get the word out about them. Wow. So it was very, you know, surreal and strange. It's funny because when I tell the stories, it sounds like I'm being all like, look how cool and hip I am. But the truth was is that nobody knew who these bands were. Nobody knew if any of these bands would be anything. And for every Green Day or Nirvana, there were a million other bands that never went anywhere. And there's a lot of tragedy within that too. I mean, I don't know how many people remember the band Blind Melon, but they were really, really big. I remember them,
I listened to them still.
Yeah, the super great guys, really interesting. And like, you know, Shannon Hoon, the singer, unfortunately passed away. And I had spoken to him just a handful of days before he passed, literally on the tour bus. There's a lot of sort of tragedy within it too. And again, it sounds very glamorous, but for every one that I can tell you a great story on, there were thousands of bands just never went anywhere. I recently found all the cassettes where I'd recorded all my interviews on. I mean, they were talking about like massive bins upon massive bins of cassettes. And I was just looking at some of the names that, you know, I sort of hand wrote on the cassettes, and half of the bands, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah. What are some of the biggest lessons you learned in terms of interviewing people at that time?
Everything. You know, people okay. People tell me, people say to me all the time. I mean, there's so many different. It's a great question, and it's actually a question. And
it's a vast question. I do get that. It's true.
But I often get asked it, but I will say this. You know, one is, you know, when I do my conversations now, I don't do interviews. I do conversations. Yeah. That's really about that. Why? Because they would trot us in as the media, every new journalist, every 15 minutes, and everybody would ask the band the same thing. So, tell me why your album's called this. Why did you use this producer? When are you going through it? And I realized that these guys are so bored.
Yeah.
And so I would go in there and try and figure out things about them and have a conversation. I'd go in with no notes and I would just talk to them. And I think that that really propelled me. I think that going forward, if people like my podcast, Six Pixels of Separation, what they're actually hearing is 10 years of me interviewing all those types of artists, you know, 8-12 times a week. And that sort of, they're getting now the benefit of those conversations where I still do that. I just have a conversation with somebody. I don't have an interview. You know, even things like I just did an like I tend to not do a lot of verbal cues, or I tend to be very quiet when somebody else is talking. These are all like little subtle skills you pick up along the way of doing that. Also, from my perspective, I think being able to have conversations with people like that makes it actually easier to have conversations with everybody else. But there's a lot of things that happen, and they're very nuanced in the depth of those conversations that I think really did prepare me for the career that I presently have, understanding how brands are built, how hard it is to build, word of mouth. I mean, all of these things that we take for granted, I watched very, very interestingly creative people do it in a world that didn't have the internet. And I don't take that for granted. And a lot of the reasons why I do the things that I do now to even promote my own work, I do based off of what I saw back then.
Yeah, got it. And did you have, was there a lot of interest in technology for you at that particular point or growing up, or was that parallel with this kind of work or not particularly?
Very parallel. I came from a lower middle class family. We didn't really have, you know, four brothers. My parents would buy us tech to share instead of buying us each a holiday gift. So, you know, very early days of having the Pong system or the Atari 800 computers, a dot matrix printer, very early days, modem, very early days. So yeah, tangentially in my life, there was always not only just my own interest in technology, but actually being able to have it around me. So yeah, I mean, I always tinkered with that stuff and I was always fascinated with that stuff. And that always had a level of high intense curiosity for me. And it's funny because I'll run into people now who I knew from my music industry days and they're like, oh my God, like I can't believe what you did with your life. And they're always like, what was that connection between like being a rock writer and where you're at now? And I'm like, I don't find it that big of a chasm. To me, yeah, it was music, but it was media, it was advertising, it was branding, it was telling stories. And the only thing that really changed is I decided that I didn't want to limit myself to just being in one specific genre of music, and that I actually had a deep interest in both technology and business. So the application of it to me seems very natural and seamless. But I guess if you're, you know, some famous rock star and you remember me just interviewing you, you wouldn't make the connection. But, you know, again, I was publishing magazines back in the early days when the only scanners were like the Logitech handheld scanners. And the layout was, you know, whatever it was called, PageMaker or whatever it was called back then. So we were using this stuff in early days, and it's very symbiotic right now to what we see in the publishing world now online. So it just, to me, it was all just natural transitions from early gaming platforms and technology and connectivity and printers and computers and layouts to where we're at today.
Yeah. Wow. And so even though the link was natural, what was the next thing for you after you left you had the magazine for a few years, and after that?
Yeah. After that, I decided that it was enough. It was really hard. We were sort of publishing two magazines and helping out a third. We were just a handful of people. It was a lot of work. I wasn't sure where it was going from a financial standpoint. So I sort of decided I want to take a bit of a break. I was really burned out and stressed about the whole thing. I wound up helping out a local, I guess they're like a nonprofit that were trying to help promote the region, basically saying to young people, you know, you can stay in Montreal and be successful, even if you're not purely Francophone. And that wound up having me interview and connect to a lot of local entrepreneurs. I wound up meeting people who had launched, again, this is prior to Google, one of the first meta search engines on the internet. They asked me to join. I thought it was interesting. I always loved all that stuff as we talked about, joined that, spent a lot of time there. You know, from there, I did a small stint in a content, mobile content company. And again, we're talking about 16 years.
So is that the
height
of the dot-com, kind of late 90s we're talking, or?
Yeah, just after the dot-com bust, I did that. I did a small stint in a PR agency that focused on technology. Wasn't my thing. Actually went back, started a record company with a buddy in Toronto. That did fairly well. But at the same time, I met my business partners here at Twist Image, now Miram. And that was really when I said, I'm going to sort of stick with this thing. And, you know, here we are 16 years later, and I guess I stuck with it.
Yeah, which is fantastic. You built a really successful agency and like sold to one of the biggest groups around. So,
yeah, it's fun.
And what do you think are some of the things that made you successful as an agency? Or what were you known for when you started? That's two questions, but, you know.
We always, you know, it's funny. We looked at it and thought there's a lot of advertising agencies, but at the time in 2000, you have to remember 2002 when I joined, they started the company in 2000, I joined in 2002. At the time, a lot of marketers were very scared of what was happening with the internet and technology. A lot of the brands had the websites or anything digital they were doing sort of locked into IT. Yeah. Marketing wasn't talking to IT. IT wasn't talking to marketing. Marketing didn't understand IT. IT felt that marketers didn't understand the web. And we just looked at it like we could be the bridge to help these brands really do something with digital. And of course, as the years progressed, it changed in terms of the sentiment, but it somewhat stayed the same, where it was about how do we help brands and businesses through all of this disruption. And, you know, here we are in 2016, and one of the core pillars of what we do at Miram is business transformation. Yeah. And what is business transformation? It's helping brands transition towards what we would call a digital first experience for their customers. So a lot changes for sure. The dynamics are completely different. But at the core, using technology to make your brand more efficient and effective, I think is just always going to be the thing. What makes it ultimately unique, I think it's the people and the team and the output of the work we're doing for the clients. The dynamics of the clients are very, very different. Why does one client work with one agency versus it doesn't work with another? Why is one agency able to output certain work with a client, but if another agency switches in, they can't? Those dynamics are very, very fluid. There's culture within that. There's teams within that. Teams change. People are added. So I think it's just the uniqueness of the relationship and how the flow happens.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by digital first for a new company? I have ideas about what it might mean, and it might be different for each company. I'm not too sure, but
I think there's been a level of sophistication for brands that understand that if you're going to do, let's say, a campaign, that if the way the campaign is introduced by the agency, or even if it's an internal team, is here's what the 30-second spot looks like, it's a bit antiquated. But the truth is that primarily most agencies still think and present like that. It's astonishing to me, but they still do.
I tend
to look at things purely from what does the customer do? Somebody hears about a brand, what's their next action? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, a 10-year-old thing, but it's still happening now, right? It happens now. Maybe they ask Siri, or they ask their Amazon Echo, you know, or they type it into Google, or they ask on a social network, or somebody Snapchats a, whatever it is. That digital first posture, I think, is how we all intuitively as consumers interact with brands. And yet, if you look at the assets and if you look at the ecosystem of brands, they mostly fail miserably. My, you know, great example is, and I call these all market of ones because they're happening to me, and maybe it's not substantiated throughout the entire universe, but in my world, it's big. My car lease is up, and I'm looking at a bunch of different cars and options and considering not having a car, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I find it astonishing that I'll pull up to a dealership and either I'm waiting for somebody or trying to, you know, go in and check out a car, and I'll go onto the mobile world, my iPhone, and look at the brand and just try and build the car that I want to build and go to the sales rep and go, here, this, what would that cost me? And I can tell you, across the vast majority of brands, it's been a complete failure of experience.
Yeah.
And you have these brands that are investing hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars into their engine of marketing, and the first point is a complete consumer experience failure. And again, I'm using it as a market of one, but I find it consistently, whether it's a small store shop or a massive global brand that's spending millions. To me, that's indicative of a brand that's not living in what I would call a digital first experience. They're not just they're not thinking about it that way. They're still so focused on probably 30-second spot, newspaper ads, dealership issues, blah, 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 that they don't realize that I, as a consumer, I just don't like, I don't care about the politics or the dogma. I just want to be able to go on, and much like you can with an Uber or Tinder or whatever, go, you know, this color, boom, that interior, boom, this package, boom, and go. And they'll tell you, well, you can do that, but you can't. If you go and try it, it's really a less than web experience. And I just think that we've transcended. Consumers have moved forward, and most brands are just failing the game. As much as they think they're doing great, most of them are just failing the game.
Yeah, got it. And actually, that brings me to one of the points I was interested in talking about or having your point of view on. There's a lot of agencies and a lot of kinds of agencies out there trying to help brands move into this digital space, take advantage of it. And they seem to be increasingly competing for the same, while worrying about the same pot of money, or trying to get the ears of the same kinds of people or different kinds of people on the board. So what I mean by that, management consultancies have been acquiring creative agencies, design agencies are looking at doing branding agencies are looking at doing digital work, PR agencies are taking care of social media, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's becoming increasingly blurry as to who's responsible for what in this kind of new emerging world that still everybody's trying to figure it out. And as you said, the brands are trying to figure it out as well. Did you have an opinion about like who's going to be the best to help them go through this thing and get them to digital first? Aside from, of course, you could say you, but you know.
Yeah, and I don't think they're figuring it out. I think it's a land grab, and everybody wants to have a piece of it. You have large media companies that need to sustain in a world where programmatic and people taking trading tables, trading systems internally. Yeah. So they're trying to do the work that we have specialized in. You have advertising agencies saying, "Oh, it's all about the idea, and we do everything," and they're trying to take the work. And you have platforms like Google and Facebook telling you, hey, if you spend money with us, we'll give you the creative for free. Mm-hmm. You have publishers like BuzzFeed and Huffington Post offering creative services for native advertising and beyond.
Which are now their biggest the biggest desks and a number of employees, actually, I hear from, I think, BuzzFeed and a couple of others in Huffington Post. Like, there's, you know, huge departments of people dedicated entirely to doing brand work, and almost the same as an agency.
Yeah. And so you go down the line, and that's just a handful. And there's many more competitive forces that are at play. Why? Because dollars are transitioning there. People's attention and time is transitioning there. And everybody wants a piece of that revenue and a piece of that action in a more globalized world, in a world that's becoming more and more consolidated. So it's super, super challenging and super stressful. Mm-hmm. The analogy that I tend to give in a very simplistic way is that do you really want to go full service? Well, you know, again, you can go full service, but my analogy is if I blew out my knee running today, I wouldn't necessarily want to go see my GP. I'd probably want to go see the specialist, the person who's worked, you know, here in Montreal and the Montreal Canadiens guys' knees like that. And I think that the digital agencies that are super strong are those specialists. Mm. And I believe the model of agency of record is somewhat antiquated. And I heard many years ago, one of the major search consultants in the US was calling them agencies of record. And I think that's the opportunity is for brands to build really strong and efficient specialized teams in the work that they do. And you're right. I'm saying this because it's in my best interest to say that. There's no doubt. And I'm sure that if I worked for a mass advertising agency, I'd say, why would you do that? And make the counter argument to that. Mm. But I just think that because of the access, connectivity, and consolidation, brands who spend the time and energy really can efficiently pull together the best teams to get the best work done. I just don't believe that there is a catch-all for all of this stuff. And even when it comes to being very, very specialized in a certain type of media, yeah, we can do a lot of these digital platforms, whether it's a complicated Facebook play or even a Google play. But I'm not drunk. I know very well that there are specific companies that just optimize and specialize in Google AdWords. And that if we have a client that has that type of depth of need, it would be bad for me not to refer them to somebody at that level of specialty. Yeah. But to claim that we do it all and we do it all amazingly in a world of so much, I think is also wrong.
Yeah, got it. And one other thing I'm thinking of is, because the other thing I'm hearing about and that we read about is younger talent, people coming out, graduating now, or who have been in working for, just a few years, becoming increasingly disenchanted, either whether it's working within brands and marketing departments or for agencies, or some of them are not even getting into agencies at all, just starting their own business, and they just don't want to, they don't like the fact that the brands are not really getting together on that side of things. Is there anything that the industry could be doing to attract or reattract these kinds of young people into it, do you think? Or,
well, I want to be clear. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that there are more – there's definitely more and more young people entering into the marketing and advertising space than ever before in the history of the industry. Okay. The issue is that they're not necessarily going to ad agencies.
Right.
They are going to places like Google and Amazon and BuzzFeed and Huffington Post, a startup that's doing media, a traditional media publisher that's trying to be more digital. So there's been fragmentation in terms of the places in which they can go. And again, historically, the number one light tower, the sort of place you wanted to go was to the best of the best agencies.
Yeah.
That's not happening anymore. Now, what can agencies do to do that? It's a tough call. I mean, it's a tough call to say, how does an agency become more interesting than going to work at, my buddy Harley Finkelstein, who's the chief operating officer at Shopify? Mm. Hard to say. His office in Montreal is right down the block from mine, and they're more than happy to pay a 20% plus premium for talent because it's cheaper for them to do that in Canada than to open an office in Silicon Valley. They're more than happy to offer things like free gourmet foods and having a cleaning service at your house twice a month. Wow. And those are
pretty impressive perks.
Exactly. So it makes it highly competitive in a world where, agencies are very much run by thin margins and not crazy Silicon Valley evaluations with that type of money. And there's an efficiency of agencies, which is why brands have historically worked with us, where the margins are tight and mm-hmm. we're running things on a very thin line in terms of the budgets to make sure that we're as efficient as possible for clients. So there is a huge paradox there in terms of how you attract talent in a place where all of those perks are there. Ultimately, what I think it boils down to is the type of work and the type of people that are in that environment. I know people who've been working at Google for a long time and really don't want to eat lunch there, even though there's 15 different cafeterias and gourmet chefs. They're sort of tired of that experience, which leads me to believe that people get tired of everything. So what keeps them there? Well, hopefully the work and the people that they're working with.
Yeah, we can get easily tired of everything, actually. It's quite impressive from that perspective. Well, thank you for the... Yeah,
my running joke is that even supermodels get divorced, right? It's like somebody eventually is like, I'm okay with that. I don't need that anymore.
Yes, so exactly.
Like, It's how we are as human beings.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing from an organizational point of view. Back to your early point about brands that are like having a hard time getting digital first and understanding how customers are going through the experience of purchasing and finding out about their products and services. And ultimately, the kind of failing seems to be an organizational point of view, or if you boil it down to, you know, human beings working together somehow.
Yeah.
Or it seems to be. I don't know what you think, but.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Let's see. What else do we want to talk about? Well, so your blog and your podcast, 6 Pixels of Separation, right?
Yeah.
You started that about 10 years ago. Did you start it at the same time as the agency, more or less? Or
it's been over 10 years for the blog, for sure. I think it was 2003. So it's probably been 13, 14 years. And the podcast is a bit over 10 years also, yeah.
Yeah. What did you have in mind when you started? I don't know if you believed or if you thought it'd be running 10 years later, just as big as this or not, but.
Well, the world's changed. So, I mean, is it just as big? I think that there are less people who are reading and connecting with that type of content in a world where they're getting more on Twitter and Facebook videos and YouTube videos and Snapchat and stuff.
Well, big's probably not exactly the right word, but I meant to certainly, like, or at least, you know, you keep it something for 10 years. And certainly the podcast, because you're at more than 500 episodes, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's
So
consistency,
I think
the going through 10 years is what I was meaning to compliment, which I didn't do very well.
No, I appreciate it for sure. No, listen, I love both the blog and the podcast very, very dearly. I think it's a natural thing when you do something for 10 plus years with the regularity and frequency that I do that you start liking one over the other sometimes. So I'm currently in a mindset of I really am loving the conversations and the people that I have on the podcast. Mm. And I'm not struggling with the blog at all. I still love to write, but it's just a different sort of spirit. Writing has become a little bit tougher for me than having the conversations, which again is fine and normal. And it's just a sort of ebb and flow. And I'm sure it'll shift back at one point soon. I just love doing it. And I people laugh when I say this because I always say it's a do as I say, not as I do. But I do not check any analytics. I have never logged in. I have no idea how many people like it, download it, check. I have no idea on either. I just don't. And people always go, come on. And I'm serious. You can ask anybody who works with me. I don't even have a login. I don't even know where to go to look to see what keywords people use or whatever it is. I don't. Because it's a labor of love. And I really look at it as my creative output. Every day during the week, I have a moment where I can reflect on something. I see something, I can comment on it and share it. I like having the hub of 6 Pixels of Separation. I do share a lot of stuff on Facebook and Twitter as well. But I like having that sort of place where I can publish because, again, you go back to my career of writing and publishing. I just love having my own little space where I don't have to call an editor and say, hey, do you want an article on this? I can just publish anything I think about. So I love it. I mean, I love it dearly. And it's nice when people say that they love it too, because I really don't sort of focus on that as much as I probably should.
Yeah. And so, of course, I've just started recently on the podcasting side of things, and you've been doing it, you know, for a long time and even more longer if you consider all the interviews in the music industry. I was wondering, like, plus starting a new agency and, you know, having worked and grown your own agency, which probably is, you know, I know it's certainly a busy job as well. How did you organize yourself from a logistic point of view to keep pushing the podcast through and organize it? Did you carve, like, do you have any particular fashion to carve time for it?
No.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's
so
funny.
I was hoping for some kind of wisdom there, but.
Yeah. I always default back to somebody who I'm able to say I know and love dearly, which is Seth Godin. And the more I hear people ask him about his process and how he responds, the more I just steal from him. I don't think it's really relevant.
He's a good person to steal from, that's for sure.
Exactly. I don't think there's anything really relevant in that in terms of, like, when do I do it? Like, I don't think that helps anybody. I think that when you have a direction, and the direction for me for, let's talk about the podcast, is primarily what's going on right now in the world that I'm seeing in terms of books, thinking, platforms, strategies? Mm. Who do I know who I could speak to about that so I could learn more about it and clear up some of the thinking that's in my brain about it and bounce ideas with somebody?
Yeah.
Now, normally you would say, hey, Mitch, I want to meet for a coffee so we can talk about blah, blah, blah. And we do that. The difference with the podcast is that all I do on top of that is I hit the record button. And then when that conversation is done, I hit the publish button.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's a very selfish act in terms of me going like, why is that person doing this? Or why is this something new? And what's going on there? And I always tell people that I feel that I get the most out of my podcast because I feel like I'm clarifying and crystallizing some of the things that are going on inside my brain.
Yeah.
And I feel the blog is the same way too. If I'm attracted to, you know, I'm very fortunate I get to go to the TED conference every year. I've been going for many years. And this past year, there was a standout presentation by someone who was talking about what it's like to be a misfit. She's a very well-known author. Okay. And it was very reminiscent for me of when I first saw Susan Cain talk about introverts. It really struck a chord in me where think about my background, punk, heavy metal, a bit of a misfit for sure. Mm. And there are certain things I do in my life. And I'm like, why do I do that? Like, why am I not in, like, why do I like going to see movies alone? Or why am I? I'm very okay with people not liking me, which is like a strange thing. Like most people are like, you know, how do I respond to this person or what do I say? In my brain, I'm like, I don't really care what someone thinks if I respond honestly. And there's a bit of that misfit actually in me. And that speech really resonated with me and it resonates with me. And then I see on TED last week, they posted the TED talk.
Okay, great. I'll have to check it out. I haven't seen it.
Well then, so you're right. So then Friday, you know, I blogged about it. So like, it's not really related to the world of marketing, communications, advertising, but there was an earworm there. There was an earworm when I saw the talk, you know, several months ago. There was an earworm when it popped up. And to me, those are indicators that it's something I should share, talk about, comment on. And those are the ways in which I think about content creation. I don't think about jamming it with keywords for a search engine optimization. All of those things were started as a way for me to share thinking. My hope is that when I share this thinking, other senior marketers, people coming into the industry will hear, consume, read, share, and think, oh, I need a great agency. Who should I call? Why don't I call that Mitch Joel guy? He seems to be really passionate about some of the same things I'm passionate about. And that's the strategy.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear because it took me a little while to figure out as well, but it's essentially, well, I've been thinking the same thing, which is I really enjoy having conversations like this, like we're having on several topics, including game design, including branding and marketing. And it's a great way to get some people to talk because otherwise they're like, well, I am very busy. So what's the end result of this? I really want to have coffee or want to have a conversation with you. So publishing it is a way to say, hey, let's make it beneficial for everyone.
It's the master trick.
So how did you choose the voice? Was there any particular choice in podcasting? Did you listen to podcasts in the first place when you started or?
There wasn't much at the time when I started.
Yeah, because that was a while ago. So even just podcasting went through ebbs and flows. It's like it's back in fashion these days, but it went through.
Well, look, back then, my buddy Joseph Jaffe had a very popular show called Jaffe Juice, and I've had Joe on the show probably more times than episodes he's created for Jaffe Juice. Or his podcast was called Across the Sound. Back then, there was Shel Holtz and Neville Hobson who were doing For Immediate Release. There was one called Inside PR, which was Terry Fallis and David Jones. There was just sort of like a handful of sort of really known communications marketing ones. Mm-hmm. At the time, I really wasn't doing conversations. My podcast was more stream of consciousness, talking about things in the media, things that were out. It was really sort of me just talking,
right,
almost like this. And then something clicked where I was like, I always loved Charlie Rose. I love Howard Stern. I love those types of conversations. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to have conversations with the people that are most fascinating to me now in terms of business and thinking. And I'm not at all comparing myself to either of those two amazing luminaries, but I wanted to steal a poor man's version of that type of in-depth conversation about those types of topics with that same type of meandering around conversations less questions. And that's been the game the whole way through. And I'm not tired of it yet. The truth is, if I was tired of the format, I would just kill it.
Yeah, you'd probably do something else, of course. Yeah. Cool. A couple of other questions. Something caught my attention when I was looking up your profile and saying that you contribute or participate regularly with an organization called Baycrest. That sounded interesting. I thought I'd ask you about who they were.
Yeah. it's been very tangential and very minor, but Baycrest is a long-term care facility that focused primarily on the elderly. Mm. But over the years has obviously, you know, if you think about elderly people, the issues are really sort of brain-related, memory, Alzheimer's, things like that. And they're just very focused on brain health now. And they called a bunch of people. I happen to be one of them to help them on their communications. It's very early days in terms of my involvement. I think I've only done 3 or 4 meetings with them and have been primarily on the phone. They're based in Toronto and I've been in Montreal when the meetings happen. And it's just really about what can we do to create better awareness and have people think differently about brain health and what it means. So just that's primarily what that one is. I try and do as much charitable/community work as possible. I often tell people that you need to do stuff within your industry, you need to do stuff within your community, you need to do stuff within your country, you need to do stuff internationally. I haven't been great at hitting all of those pillars, primarily because business, life, family, kids. Yes. But I do think about it often and I do try and be involved when I can.
Are there other things that you do in your off time aside from the agency and, well, I guess the podcast and thinking about the industry?
Look, I have a young, very, very young family. So most of my time is spent racing home so that whether it's travel or even when I'm here to make sure that I'm a very present parent.
Yeah.
That's where I spend a lot of my time. And I also find that doing that opens up a lot of things because you're teaching and learning and doing things that maybe you forgot to do or are being reintroduced to or seeing it through their eyes. I have still a deep passion, as we talked about, for music. So I have that bass podcast that I do on the side. I also still do a metal podcast, not really all that frequently, with 2 other people that I respect from that world. And we do a short little sort of 15-minute conversation thing. Mm. I read a lot. I write a lot. I hopefully spend enough time with my family and friends. It's I lead a very blessed life, a very charmed life. And I'd like to think a very busy life too.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It certainly sounds like it's particularly busy. Actually, talking about the activities as a family might be an interesting segue because I usually ask a few, the last kind of questions, I'm calling the sort of cool down questions to cross-relate a few of my interests. And one of my interests is in gaming and tabletop gaming in particular. So I'm not sure how old your children are, but I was wondering if that's an activity that you do as a family sometimes, like board games or even video games or things like that.
Yeah, it's funny. We keep having this conversation about video games. I'm not anti-video games at all by any sort of stretch of the imagination. I actually love them. It's just, again, my kids are super young and I'm trying to do my best to stave off the maniacal obsession, addiction to that as long as possible. So I sort of handle that in fits and bursts and not that sort of like all my kids have screens and devices. People are usually very surprised when they see how they don't have devices. And I jokingly tell people who are grown up that we don't even have what we would call a family iPad. We have multiple tablets, but we make sure that the children understand that it's mine. Mm-hmm. And that if they want to use mine, they have to borrow it so that it's not sort of all that quote unquote accessible to them. But on the board game side, yeah, we're crazy about that stuff. So now they're of the age where we're getting into things like chess, and mm-hmm. checkers and Connect Four and Love Letter and card games. And I have, as we talked about, 3 other brothers. 2 of them are really big into that whole genre of board games and custom games. So I don't think it'll be long before they're into the whole Pokemon Magic card games and then also all these other crazy games that they're playing.
Brilliant. Excellent. It's good to know. One classic, of course, that I asked because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Favorite ice cream flavor?
Oh, now listen. So you don't know this, but Montreal has a very large passion around artisanal ice cream and stuff that. So I'm somewhat of an ice cream snob.
Okay.
There's a great place here called Bilboquet, which is, again, artisanal ice cream. In fact, it's done so well that they're now becoming more of a chain. Mm-hmm. And they have an amazing ice cream called a Brouhaha, which is like vanilla with caramel and pieces of brownie. And when I feel like I can afford any form of extra calories, I will indulge in that. That being said, I am a very big sucker for a great high quality soft serve.
Okay, cool. That's a good classic answer. Oh, I'll have to definitely check out. It gives me one more reason to visit Montreal.
Then. Oh, yeah. You'll love it up here.
And a large and vast random question. Sometimes I try those for the sake of it. Talking about technology, like, do you have any ideas of either new technologies or new trends that would be helping or even going to the extent to revolutionize the way we make or consume ice cream?
It's funny because, like, my first reaction until you said ice cream was just voice. I think that Amazon Echo, Siri, all of this technology, us using our voice to control technology is becoming very predominant. Can that play into ordering ice cream making? For sure. On the technology side, in terms of ice cream, what I am thinking about is more that sort of new cooking technique, that whole sous vide and that whole movement around, you know, using Internet of Things connectivity and technology to develop different types and formats. I think that that's going to affect not just ice cream, but that type of industry dramatically. Yeah.
That on the purely technology side of things, I absolutely agree with you on the voice. And I was watching your talk that you gave a talk at Inbound the Inbound conference last year, I believe, talking about, we're going to have to go. I think the movement is to go to devices that we don't have to use our hands and be looking, you know, outside of the world. Like, cause we have to use our hands to look at our screens. Right. And, you know, we're closing ourselves to the world rather than, I think the next phase is going to be being able to use whatever is those devices, but being able to look at other people and talk with other people at the same time. And was there another, because this Amazon Echo is one that has a lot of promise right now, but I still haven't tried it. But isn't there another one that just came out? Is it a Google device or some other voice device that just came out?
Yeah, well, Google is working very aggressively on that type of a similar device, which they announced very recently at their developers conference.
Right, that's what it was.
We can't discount what Apple will do with Siri. That voice technology is getting more powerful. I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of it integrated into cars. Think about Tesla and things like that. But I'm very bullish on voice as the new navigation. It's not necessarily a new saying. We've been talking about this for a while.
Yeah.
But I feel like the technology really is catching up. And I know the people who have the Amazon Echo and who are playing with it are really seeing the...
Just actually, for anybody who might be listening who doesn't know, can you just quickly describe what the Amazon Echo is?
A little device. The newer one looks like a hockey puck. Some of them look so almost like a little, like almost one of those bottles you use to refill water with. And it just sits in your house. It's present. And it's not just about ordering Amazon on which you can do, but you can just tell it, it's Alexa is the name of it. You can say, hey, Alexa, what's the weather? Or, hey, Alexa, can you even lower the lights in the room? And if it's connected to other things in the house, it's almost like that Star Trek computer that you would just sort of speak to, and it has answers and can solve things and can help you with things. Even I've had friends who are doing math homework with their kids and they just, Alexa, what is? And here come the answers out of it. And it's apparently a very, very smart device.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I've noticed and I believe the trend to go to voice is going to be there, but I'm remarked on, I noted my own behavior is not there at all. So I was talking to a colleague, my old boss, George Nima, who I interviewed for the podcast as well. And we both have Nexus Android devices. And he told me that he uses the voice control a lot and that the voice to typing is really effective. But I just realized how much I never think about it at all. I just go automatically to typing. Just like I've not really transitioned to using much of a tablet. I really like my keyboard.
Well, I'm used to that's it. Yeah, and that's something a little bit different. I can tell you as somebody who writes and has written for a living that the way you type is not the same as when you write your thoughts down with pen, which is not the same as when you text your thoughts down, which is not the same as when you say your things down, which is not the same as when you type on glass. They're all very, very different.
Yeah.
And I believe the output of what's happening in your brain comes out differently depending on what the output is. So I can tell you that when I speak into, you know, that voice recognition software that'll turn it into text, the content never reads the same as my voice, quote unquote, sounds when I write from my brain to type. I don't think that we're ever going to see a natural way in which, and again, if you don't believe me, take and write down 50 words about, you know, the scenery outside on your computer, type it in, and then do the same exercise, 50 words about the scenery, but write it by pen, and you'll just read both of them and see that, wow, the voice is completely different.
Mm. That's funny. That's quite interesting, actually. And writing it down by hand is an interesting one. Actually, last week, it just makes me think. I just had a few things, and I thought I haven't sent a handwritten letter in years. So I got a few postal addresses. I'm going to write some handwritten letters to friends. Did you? When's the last time you wrote one? Do you remember?
I keep a little stack of cards here, and I try every week to send one or two handwritten notes to someone.
Oh, that's a great practice.
I wish I was very religious with it. I'm not. I can miss several weeks and or months, but the box is here. I'm staring at it right now, and I'm feeling guilty for not having written them. Well, I like to do that. Because look, I remember
feel
like
feel guilty.
Yeah. But no, but I remember, like, I do remember notes that I get from people, cards that I get thanking me versus you get an email. You go, wow, that's really nice. Yeah. Thanks so much. And delete versus there's still something about the physicalness, the artifact of it that I still enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I keep my letters and I have my letters from when I was a teenager that exchanged a bunch of letters. And I thought it was interesting because the last ones I sent, I was traveling for a long time, a few years ago. And that's why I sent some letters out. And there's something interesting in the letters that I wrote and sent. Well, I don't have that anymore versus everything I write in my blog. I have records of everything, which is nice to have too, but there's something ephemeral and nice in the fact that it's something that I've written, spent time on, sent to someone, they get to keep, but I don't really have a record of it anymore.
Yeah. So, I hear you.
Interesting. Anyhow, so it's just like parting thoughts. It's just to finish off. Is there anything exciting or that we should know about coming in the future? Because we know there's like, you know, you've got two books out that people can check out, right?
Yeah. First one is called 6 Pixels of Separation. Second one is called Control Alt Delete. Both of them have been out for several years. Yep. My blog always, which you can find, if you just go to mitchjoel.com, it's the easiest to redirect you where that is, the podcast, 6 Pixels of Separation. I'll have a third book probably soon at some point. I haven't really started writing it, just sort of thinking about it and putting a title in place and tweaking things as I speak to see if the book is there. And once the water breaks, the baby will arrive.
Cool. And are you speaking at any events soon that people could know about that you should check out that it can add to the show notes?
Nonstop. Yeah. I'll be at Content Marketing World, which I'm sure some of your audience will be at. I'll be probably again at Inbound HubSpot if everything works out. Mm-hmm. And just again, if you just sort of Google my name, you'll see a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different talks that are available on YouTube as well.
For sure.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Mitch. I really, really appreciate it. It's great.
Well, thanks for the great questions. I appreciate you.
All right. Cool. Have a great day. Bye. All right, another episode wrapping up. Thank you so much for listening. We're coming up to the end of the season of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I think I mentioned that in the last episode very quickly. I'm working out exactly how I'm wrapping up the season. I have a very exciting season finale episode I've just recorded that's going to come out in a few weeks. However, I don't know exactly like when I'll start the second season. I'm going to do something throughout the summer anyway. Something, maybe just short episodes, musings, something like that. I'm not sure. Anyhow, if you enjoyed the episode, how about sharing it with a friend, essentially? Or post it on your social media, post it on your Facebook or your Twitter. Just share it with somebody else. I mean, I just want more people to be listening to the show. You can send them a link of the file. You can even send by email. Or even better, take a few minutes, as I said at the beginning, to write a review on iTunes or on your, you know, your iPhone podcasting app, essentially. If you have any feedback, questions, comments, I also love to hear from you all the time. You can contact me on Twitter. My username is @HippoWill. I've been considering changing my username. I've had that one for a long time, and a lot of my usernames are HippoWill, which is just basically a silly name. It was available. I like hippos. I kind of like the ring of it, but it doesn't have anything to do with Ice Cream for Everyone. But I haven't really found a better way to go for Ice Cream Will, but there's a few more characters. I don't know. Not sure. Anyway, you can also post a comment on the Ice Cream for Everyone page on Facebook. You can like it on Facebook. Or you can just send me an email, drop me a note at Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, @icecreamforeveryone.net. That's about it for now. Have a fantastic morning, evening, afternoon, whatever time it is for you, wherever you're listening. Till next time. Bye.